Okay, I was reviewing the notion of a differential. We have a function at a point, then df, the differential of that function, is a cotangent vector. It is defined to do the following. Yeah. Being a cotangent vector, it can be fed a tangent vector, and it's mapping it linearly into a real number. The definition is that the cotangent vector df takes a tangent vector and maps it into the following real number. It maps it into the real number obtained by letting the tangent vector act on the function. And what will it do? It will differentiate it at a particular point, at the point P in question, and give us a number. Okay? So for every function, we obtain a cotangent vector. The cotangent vector's action on the tangent vector is that it gives us the real number obtained by letting the tangent vector heat up the function, namely differentiating it at the point in question. That's a real number. It does it linearly because this is derivative. So what we have is a map that takes functions into cotangent vectors. Map D, and this map will be very important later on. I mentioned already that it's going to be the so-called co-boundary of Golden. Concretely, in a coordinate system, how does that look like? So if we have a coordinate system, then we might look at a tangent vector psi and a function f. So let's say on our manifold, we have a tangent vector psi and a function f. If we choose a coordinate system, then in this coordinate system, we have all of that mapped into Rn, so we have that our tangent vector psi corresponds to a tangent vector eta on the point Q in Rn, and our function germ at the point P of the manifold corresponds to a function germ G at the point Q of the manifold Rn. Then, how does the differential to G act? G is a function, or function germ at the point. DG is a cotangent vector. It feeds on the tangent vector, gives us a real number. Namely, DG takes the tangent vector and maps it into what we obtain when we let the tangent vector act on the function. This is a tangent vector. In Rn, we can always write it down explicitly in this form. And it's acting on the function g by differentiation evaluated at the point q. Now, since all tangent vectors take this form, all tangent vectors are a linear combination of the partial derivatives. All tangent vectors are directional derivatives. Since this is so, we can identify the partial derivative evaluated at the point Q as the basis vector, as some basis vector of the tangent vector space. See, a general tangent vector is a linear combination of those. So these, the partial derivatives, can be viewed as basis vectors. Later on, we will choose other basis vectors, but these are convenient. If you're given a chart, why not choose those basis vectors that come automatically? But keep in mind that if you chose a different chart, you would get different basis vectors. And in general, there's no reason to choose the basis vectors that come with the chart. This freedom, actually, of choosing the basis in the tangent space independently from the chart will eventually turn out to be the gauge principle for general relativity. But for now, let's just say this is a basis. Then what is the dual basis in the cotangent space? Remember from linear algebra, if you have a basis in a vector space, its dual vector space has a dual basis. So what is the basis that is dual to the basis that we just wrote down? For that purpose, let us consider the following function. Remember that for each function, we can define a cotangent vector. Let us look at the coordinate function.
we have chosen a chart, we have chosen a coordinate system, so we can look at the coordinate function. If the coordinate function xk is mapping points in Rn into the k coordinate. So this is just a scalar function, which is k. Not a vector at all, right? Just a function on the manifold. It maps points of the manifold into real numbers, namely into the xk coordinate. And what is the differential of such a function? The differential of a coordinate function xk is a cotangent vector, of course. And as such, it maps tangent vectors into a real number in a linear way. Concretely, the differential of a coordinate function maps this particular tangent vector, remember that's the basis vector, into the number that we get when we let the tangent vector act on the function in question. That was the general rule. The differential is obtained in this way. And what is that? Well, that is the the number that we obtain here is the number that we obtain when we differentiate xk with respect to xi at the point in question. And that is, of course, just the Kronecker delta ik. Can you close that door, please? So we've identified the dual basis. See, we've seen that when we apply the differential of a coordinate function on such a basis vector, then we obtain delta ik. This is exactly what defines a dual basis. Therefore, the dual basis in the cotangent space is given by the differentials of the coordinate function. Therefore, every element of the cotangent space takes this form. You see, the tangent space is n-dimensional. Cotangent space is n-dimensional. We have bases now for both for the tangent space and the cotangent space. Bases that are suggested by the coordinate system that we have. So in particular, since we know that the cotangent space at the point Q is a vector space spanned by those differentials of the coordinate function, we know that indeed every cotangent vector at the point Q must have this form.
X of the form x to the power k.
Oh, this is not to the power. This is just a coordinate. Okay, so this is x1,
x2, x3, x4. Okay? So we are not taking the power of anything. This is just a coordinate function. This is a function that maps from Rn into R, and it maps the point into its k coordinate. Okay, so we know in particular now that since this is a basis, every cotangent vector at the point Q is such a linear combination with suitable coefficients. And so every cotangent vector acts can be written in this form, and then its action can be written in the following way. The cotangent vector feeds on tangent vectors and maps them into real numbers. Namely, the cotangent vector maps a tangent vector, and every tangent vector has this form, into the application of the cotangent vector onto the tangent vector, which is really, you remember how that works, it's the application of the tangent vector, namely the directional derivative, on this function here. So we have, well, the omega and the eta are just coefficients that by linearity we can put in front. And then we have that it's the application of the derivative onto that function here. So it's this. But remember that that derivative needs to be evaluated at the point Q in question here. it's just the Kronecker delta ij. Therefore, this double sum becomes a simple sum. And we obtain that the action of an arbitrary cotangent vector on an arbitrary tangent vector is simply this double sum, the product of the two coefficients of the cotangent vector and the coefficients of the tangent vector. We will keep this in mind, and that's why I gave this equation a red number one. Now remember that for every function, we obtain a differential. For every g, we obtain a dg. We will start looking here. There is a cotangent vector. For every function, there is a cotangent vector. Not only for the coordinate functions, but for every function, there is a cotangent vector. And we know now from the previous slide that the differential of an arbitrary function must be a linear combination of those, because those are a basis. This leads to the obvious question. Given some arbitrary function g, what are those coefficients going to be? Now, one thing we know is that when we apply the differential of a function g onto a tangent vector, then we obtain the real number that is calculated by applying the tangent vector onto the function g and evaluate that at the point in question. Which is, here is the tangent vector spelled out, applied to the function g, and that derivative is taken at the point in question here. Now remember equation one from above. Remember this equation here. Here we saw that the action of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector is simply the sum over the product of the coefficients. What we see here is that the action of the differential of g on a tangent vector is given by this expression here. You see, this is simply the coefficients. These are the coefficients of the tangent vector. So this, by comparison with the equation above, by comparison with this equation here, this must be the omega I. Right? So these have to be the omega I. The omega I's are the partial derivatives of g, our function at the point. Therefore, since these are the coefficients of our differential of the function in the basis dxk, we can now write that the differential of an arbitrary function, of course it's got to be differentiable and so on, but the differential of an arbitrary function is given by this linear combination of the basis of the cotangent space that we worked with, where these are the coefficients, the partial derivatives of g evaluated at the point in question. We do a little exercise, but remember you don't have to do this in tandem. The so-called pullback map. Consider a cotangent vector at an abstract point P of the abstract manifold M. Now, under two charts, it will have two images. Namely, let's say we have two charts, two coordinate systems, alpha and beta, around the point P. And then this cotangent vector will correspond to a cotangent vector at the point Q in Rn with respect to one chart, and it will correspond to a cotangent vector at the point F in Rn with respect to the other chart. Just have two coordinate systems and look at the same cotangent vector. Then we know that with respect to the one chart, our cotangent vector will have coefficients omega I, and with respect to the other chart, and I'm calling those coordinates x tilde, as we did before, last lecture, the same cotangent vector will have coefficients mu I. And then it's a little exercise for you to show that the coefficients in one chart will be related to the coefficients in the other chart through this equation, through this transformation rule. Remember that we carried out the similar calculation for the tangent vector and calculated how are their coefficients in one chart related to their coefficients in another chart. And we found a very similar equation, except that here we had a different matrix. We had the inverse of that matrix. We had simply the Jacobian matrix of the chart change, going from one chart alpha to another chart beta. And here we now obtain the inverse Jacobian matrix. The traditional physicist's definition of the cotangent space is using that. It's saying that any n tuple of numbers that transformed in this way will be called a cotangent vector. Some notation and terminology, which you probably know. Elements of the tangent space at the point B are called contravariant vectors, and elements of the cotangent space at the point B are called covariant vectors. Often one writes symbolically the tangent vector at the point P of the manifold as some linear combination of partial derivatives, even if we haven't really chosen a coordinate system just yet. It's saying, well, once you choose a coordinate system, it will take that form. And similarly, even when you're working on the abstract manifold and some abstract point P, sometimes you may want to write your covariant vectors, your cotangent vectors, in this form, where, of course, as long as you haven't chosen a coordinate system, it doesn't really make much sense. But of course, you know that your abstract omega is going to map, going to be mapped into one of these expressions once you are choosing a coordinate system. So I just wanted to alert you to that so that you don't get too confused when you see that later on. I try to be specific though, but it may occasionally happen that I use this method. Then we move on to tensors. I guess you've all been expecting this for a while. So the definition is that the tensor T of rank R, S, and we say it's R fold contravariant and S fold covariant, is an element of the tensor product space of all those vector spaces. Remember that TTM, the tangent vector space, is an n-dimensional vector space if the manifold is n-dimensional. And we take the tensor product of R of them. So we get R contravariant tensor spaces and S covariant ones. And we say that this high-dimensional vector space now, you see it has n times n times n times n times n dimensions. We call that the tensor space at the point P of the manifold. In a chart, we can choose, we don't have to, but we can choose the bases for the tangent and the cotangent space that we discussed. And those bases easily turn into bases, into a basis also for that tensor space. We simply have to take the tensor product of the basis vectors. And then in front of that, we have some coefficients. Any tensor at the point P is a linear combination of those basis vectors. Remember that these are just real numbers. And once we make those things position dependent, then these things will depend on the position, of course. And remember what they are then. They're just functions. If you hold your indices fixed, these things are functions. Not tensors, they're just functions. Okay? But I'll come back to the point later on. Under change of chart, what we have is, by the way, I want to mention that physicists not only define cotangent vectors by their transformation properties and tangent vectors, but of course also tensors by their transformation properties. And the transformation properties of such a tensor are, of course, given by this equation here, where we have that the covariant indices and the contravariant indices of our tensor transform under change of charge in this way, where we have here the here we have the Jacobian matrices, and here we have inverse Jacobian matrices. So these are the coefficients in a chart, and these are the coefficients of the same tensor in a different chart. And we recognize, of course, that the tangent and cotangent spaces are simply special cases of tensor spaces. Namely, the tangent space is simply the tensor space that has only one contravariant component and no covariant ones, and vice versa. The cotangent space is simply the tensor space 0, 1. A tangent vector is therefore a tensor of rank 1, 0. Remember, the first index denotes how many contravariant components you have, and the cotangent vector is a tensor of rank 0, 1. So far, we've looked only at an individual point of the manifold and perhaps the neighborhood of it. Now let us consider all of the manifolds. So while so far we always looked at one point of the manifold and its tangent space, or one point of the manifold and its cotangent space, or one point of the manifold and its tensor space, now let us look at the point P and its tensor space, and in fact all of them. Let's look at all pairs of the point of a point P and its tensor space. So we will look at
that emerge from what was given online at this point.
It depends on when you downloaded it.
I updated it. Oh, well. I keep updating things. But usually, one day after I taught the class, the lectures would have set me. See, sometimes I find bugs while I teach, and then I might update the same evening. Yeah, so please don't be upset if what you download from the web isn't exactly what I teach, because I usually can't stop myself from tinkering with the text. So, okay, yes, actually I added a little bit of hyperbandwidth because I thought it was a bit cryptic before.
Yeah. Not really. I think it goes back to
the physicist's definition, where you say that something transforms with the Jacobian matrix or against the Jacobian matrix. And that's why I think there's the terminology of covariant and contravariant. But no, it's just the tradition.
Cotangent vectors on functions by defining the actions on the coordinates and then by expressing the
functions. Cotangent vector doesn't act on functions.
Sorry, the
cotangent vector acts on tangent vector.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Okay, so you're now no longer looking at just one pair,
a point and a tangent vector, but all pairs, point and a tangent vector space. And we call the union of all those pairs T of M. And we will define this as a manifold. Now, what dimension will it have? It's going to have the dimension 2M, right? Because you have that the point P out of an n-dimensional manifold, and the tangent spaces are n-dimensional manifold. Can be simply Rn. So viewed as a differentiable manifold, this is going to be the so-called tangent bundle. T of M is then also called the total space, and M, the original manifold, is also called the base space. I'm introducing this terminology because the notion of bundle, or generally fiber bundle, is more general than what we need here. And the following two slides are just an excursion into fiber bundles. We're not actually going to pursue this further, except for the little comment I go. Okay, so we want to look at all points with attention spaces, and that collection together can be viewed as a differentiable manifold. But remember what makes a differentiable manifold a differentiable manifold. It means that you must have a map, at least locally, you must have a map from this abstract manifold into Rm, such that you must have charts. And if you have several charts that cover the same patch of the manifold, then the chart changes must be differentiable. This is what makes the manifold differentiable. So when I'm saying we're looking at this union, remember there's no structure to this because we want to have a differentiable manifold. Which means that locally, we must always have that we can take a patch of this manifold and have charts, meaning mapped into Rm, where m is 2n, so the dimension is 2n of this thing, right? So we have charts from a patch of this manifold into Rm, and if you change charts for this patch, then the change of charge map has to be differentiable. At least there has to be exist at least two charts such that the change of charge is differentiable. You can always come up with charts that introduce non-differentiability, but that's just a property of the chart. If you can find charts that such that the change of charge is differentiable, then you say it's a property of the manifold that it allows that. And you call the manifold differentiable. Okay, and we come back to this business of needing to have a map into Rm or R2n. So, Tm is called the total space, and M, the manifold that we started with, is called the basis space. The map pi, which maps an element of the total space of our tangent bundle into the manifold by mapping such a pair into just the point. This is a pair is in the tangent bundle, but P is just in the manifold. This map pi is called the bundle projection. Formally, we will write that pi inverse of P is the tangent space at P, which is to say that the pre-image of P is the tangent space. The pre-image is, of course, the set of all those elements which, under the action of pi, go into the point P. So the pi inverse of P is the tangent space at the manifold, of the manifold at the point P. And if we look at the pre-image pi inverse of not just the point P, but an entire patch of the manifold, then we would get a patch of the tangent bundle. Okay? Now remember that all of our tangent spaces, all TPM are n-dimensional. At every point, the tangent space is n-dimensional. And every n-dimensional real vector space is isomorphic to any other n-dimensional real vector space. So all of those tangent spaces are isomorphic to Rn. The terminology is, therefore, that we say that Rn is the so-called standard fiber of our fiber bundle. Basically, at every point of our manifold, we attach a copy of Rn, which happens to be the tangent. And you see that this is easily generalizable. You could attach to every point of the manifold something else, not the tangent space, which is Rn, but you could attach a group, for example, a Lie group. Or you could attach the cotangent space or tensor space. In this case here, we have a standard fiber, namely Rn, which we choose to be the tangent space. So other fiber bundles are obtained by choosing other standard fibers, by attaching to each point of the manifold something else than just an n-dimensional vector space. Now, an important part of the definition of a fiber bundle is that it has to be locally trivial. Remember, it has to be, we already mentioned that, namely that the fiber bundle has to be manifold. So there have to be local patches such that those patches have charge, can be mapped into R to N. Which is also to say that our fiber bundle has to be locally trivial. You see, the charge has to have the following property. Namely that if UR is a patch of the manifold, just some region of the manifold, then its free image in the fiber bundle, pi inverse, is a patch of the entire fiber bundle. And it has to be isomorphic to the patch of the manifold partition product with Rn. Which is to say that, remember that the fiber bundle has to be a differentiable manifold. So it has to have those charts, and changes of charts have to be differentiable. Okay. But so far, that's just saying it's a manifold. Now we're saying it has to be a special manifold. It has to be such that at every, around every point of the manifold, there has to be a patch such that they are charged, so that this patch of the fiber bundle looks like that. It's just the trivial product of the patch of the manifold and Rn. So you may think, well, okay, but isn't that automatic? Well, the point is that it's not automatic. Of course, it doesn't have to be Rn. If it's other fibers, like group elements, then like a group, then this would be a group. But for our, in our case, we're dealing with the tangent bundle, and this is Rn. Let me give you an example of how it can happen that this is not trivial. You see, fiber bundles are allowed to be globally non-trivial. Look, for example, at a manifold that has a hole, like a donut. Then let's take two charts, I mean two patches. This is a patch, and here's another patch. We call them U1 and U2, and those patches have some overlap. Together, those two patches cover the entire manifold. Now let's look at the pre-image of the patch U1. That is some piece of the entire tangent vector bundle. And we are requiring that this piece is isomorphic to U1 cross Rn. Simply the Cartesian product of all points in here with all vectors in Rn. And that means there's an isomorphism that takes us from here to there. There's a diffeomorphism. There is a map that is invertible and differentiable from the original image of the manifold from of this patch into U1 plus R. Similarly, we require that this patch's pre-image, this one, is also isomorphic to U2 cross Rn, also locally trivial. So we are requiring that there exists an isomorphism between this patch and that patch that is differentiable, a diffeomorphism. But you see, the point is that in the overlap region, it may turn out that the two isomorphisms don't actually agree. They might differ. You might find that this is locally trivial. Simply, there is an isomorphism from that patch of the tangent bundle to this, or from the vector bundle to that. And here as well, there's isomorphisms, but you may actually find that they are, at this point, turned against another. See, if you show that a vector space is isomorphic to another vector space, then you're mapping vector into vector. And you can map Rn into Rn in many different ways. And you can have one, if you want to show that one Rn is isomorphic to another Rn, all you have to do is build an isomorphism between the basis space that you've chosen. But there are many isomorphisms between Rn and Rn. And you may have chosen a different isomorphism over here than over there when you look at those patches. And how can they differ? Well, they can differ by a general linear transformation that's invertible, which is to say that they may differ by elements of the general linear group. So you see that you can have that a vector bundle is locally trivial but globally not. You can think of it as like a Möbius strip, for example, where you have that locally a Möbius strip looks just like, you know, a ribbon with a tangent space attached to it. But if it's a Möbius strip, you see that you actually end up with a full, that you end up with a rotation of 180 degrees if you go one round. Now, for general relativity, the question is, does it matter? Are we expecting that this sort of thing comes up? Not obvious. As far as we can tell, the universe, as far as we can see, it doesn't have holes or handles or anything of the kind. But maybe it does. I mean, there are, maybe there are singularities in space, for example, at the origins of black holes. I'm not so sure about this. It's often expected that this might be resolved by quantum theory. In any case, we don't have any concrete applications of this business in general relativity just yet. I mean, testing thought too, of course, but I don't know of any practical application that would have led to something observable. But on the other hand, in particle physics, in gauge theories of particle physics, this sort of thing does matter. So I just thought I mentioned it anyway. But we will not really work with fiber bundles, and I will only make a little bit of a reference of it later on. So what are tangent vector fields then? When a tangent vector field is a map, psi, that takes points in the manifold into tangent vector. So it assigns to every point of the manifold a tangent vector. In a chart, it does this. A tangent vector field is a linear combination of those basis vectors. And remember that at every point in space, you get a different tangent vector space, and therefore a different basis. So this is a very compact notation, because this corresponds to infinitely many basis vectors. At every point that you may be looking at the moment, this is the basis vector. And these are just the coefficients. A cotangent vector field, similarly, is a map that assigns to every point of the manifold a cotangent vector. And in a chart, you know, it's got to be of that form, because we know that these things are basis vectors, and so these are coefficient functions in front of those basis vectors. Similarly, tensor vector fields are, of course, given in this way, where these are the coefficient functions. Tangent vector fields, cotangent vector fields, and tensor fields are also called sections of their respective fiber bundle. So for example, the tangent vector field chi is a section of the tangent vector bundle. Let's introduce a new definition here. The algebra of smooth functions, say infinity functions, from the manifold into R, we denote f of n. One can show that vector fields are the derivations of the algebra of functions on the manifold. Which means, in practice, just what we had done for a point before, we can now do for all of the manifold, or at least all of the chart at once. If psi is a contravariant vector field, then it maps functions into functions in such a way that this is linear and obeyed the Leibniz rule. You see, at the point, as long as we were still working with just one point of the manifold, a tangent vector was mapping a function germ into a number. Now, a tangent vector field is mapping functions into not just real numbers, but functions, in such a way that this map is linear and obeys the Leibniz rule. So a tangent vector field applied to the product of two functions is the tangent vector field applied to the function that is itself a function now, no longer just mapping on the real numbers, but because we do it at every point, this is giving us a function, times the function g plus the function f times the function we obtain by applying the tangent vector field on g. And that's just to be true for all functions in the space of functions f of x. This is how you can define tangent vector p. Now the following tensor fields are going to be very important. So we will spend quite a bit of time on them. And they're called differential forms. They're nothing but just tensor fields, but particular kind of tensor fields. And why would we look at this particular kind of tensor field so much? Well, those tensor fields will turn out to have particular transformation properties. And that makes them unique among all vector fields. Namely, they have this unique property that they allow integration. And that's because these vector fields, these tensor fields, have transformation properties that go hand in hand, that match exactly the transformation properties of a Jacobian that you would get or expect to get when you change coordinates in an integral. We know how that works for Rn. We need that for general manifolds. And those so-called differential forms will have just the right property. So among all tensor fields, the differential forms will be special in that respect, that only those, these and only those, can be integrated. So the set of functions on the manifold, or smooth functions, infinitely many times differentiable functions, will be called lambda zero. It's the set of so-called zero forms. The set of covariant vector fields, so the set of cotangent vector fields, will be called lambda one. And we say that they are the so-called one form. There will also be two forms, three forms, and so on. And the set of R forms, called lambda R, will be defined to be the set of totally anti-symmetric tensor fields of rank zero R. So they're going to be tensor fields, all right. They're going to have no contravariant component, but R covariant component, and they have to be totally anti-symmetric. So we are at the end of lecture set four now, I'm opening five. And then we'll define those things explicitly. So what do we mean by totally symmetric covariant tensor? Well, let's go back to just one point to start with. So we look at the cotangent space at the point, and we look at the space, especially the space of R-fold covariant tensors at the point P, where R now is larger than 1. So it's just some tensor that's covariant, has no contravariant component. Then we define the so-called anti-symmetric part of this tensor by applying the anti-symmetrization operator on our covariant tensor. So if mu is an arbitrary covariant R tensor, then we define mu tilde to be its anti-symmetrized version. And it is defined in the following way. Remember what a covariant, an R-fold covariant tensor does. It gives you a number if you feed it R tensor, R tangent vector. Remember that, what is a cotangent vector? It gives you a number if you give it, if you feed it a tangent vector, right? A cotangent vector eats up a tangent vector and gives you a number. An R-fold covariant tensor can be fed R tangent vector and will then output a number, simply because we have this tensor product. So by telling what number we obtain when you plug in arbitrary tangent vectors psi 1 to psi r, we are defining what neutral is. If we know how it acts on all possible inputs of our tangent vectors, then we know what it does. So we define nu tilde to have the following action on our tangent. You take nu, the original unsymmetrized R-fold covariant tensor, and you feed it the R tangent vector. And those indices are not 1, 2, r, but are any possible permutation of the numbers 1, 2, r. And you sum over all permutations. So fr is the group of permutations of r elements. Remember that every permutation has a sign, either plus 1 or minus 1. Whenever you change permutation by one action, you flip the sign from plus 1 to minus 1, or from minus 1 to plus 1. And you add all of this up. So you take the original un-antisymmetrized R-fold covariant tensor, feed it the tangent vectors in an arbitrary sequence, sum over all possible sequences or permutations with the respective sign of the permutation, and put a normalization factor of 1 over r factorial in front of it. Then this is going to be antisymmetric in this argument, because obviously if you just change the argument over there, you're changing all of these by just one move, and that produces a minus sign overall. Here I'm just saying again that the antisymmetrization is going to be important because it is what will guarantee that the transformation properties of those covariant tensors will be going hand in hand with the Jacobian matrix that you expect from integration when you change coordinates. And you may remember that when you change coordinates in an integral, you get the Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. That's why we need this antisymmetrization, because that will give us the determinant. You remember how the determinant is defined? A very similar expression. Let's make this a little bit more concrete here. Consider, for example, the following two forms. F is a function, g is a function. Df is therefore a cotangent vector, which is to say that it is a one form. Df is a cotangent vector, so it is also one form. Therefore, the tensor product of the two is a two form. The tensor product of the two is a two tensor. It is a two-fold covariant tensor, but it's not antisymmetric. Right? You just load it down in this way. It's not symmetric. It's not antisymmetric. It's nothing in particular. It's just some two-fold covariant tensor. Now, let us antisymmetrize this thing. Let us calculate nu tilde for that. Well, remember how nu is acting on tensor. It can feed on two tensors and will give us a number. And the way it does it is this. You can feed two tangent vectors, okay, psi 1 will go into the first tensor factor, and psi 2 into the second tensor factor. So we obtain df of psi 1 times dg of psi 2. That's a number. Which number is it? But remember how df maps psi 1 into a number. It's simply psi 1, the direction derivative, applied to the function f and evaluated at the point in question. So this is how this two-fold covariant tensor is feeding on two tangent vectors and giving us a number. Now let us apply A, the antisymmetrization operator. Now nu tilde, the antisymmetrized version of this covariant two tensor, is going to have the following action on two tangent vectors. It is df dg acting fed the two tangent vectors psi 1 and psi 2 in the original sequence with a plus sign in front of it, and then they are fed the two tangent vectors with the opposite sequence. So we've applied one permutation to this, and that produces a minus sign. Remember, from here, we have to feed new all permutations, and depending on whether they are odd or even, we get a minus sign or a plus sign. So, we get this because it's the original sequence with a plus sign, and that because it's one move away from the original sequence, there's a minus sign, and this normalizing prefactor, 1 over r factorial, in our case, is just 1 over 2. And because it's a 2 tensor. So this is the action of the anti-symmetrized 2 tensor. Therefore, the anti-symmetrized version of this 2 tensor is given by that. Okay? Because if we take this two tensor and feed it two tangent vectors, psi 1 and psi 2, we get exactly this expression. So the anti-symmetrized image of our original covariant two tensor is this. And this now is a differential form, it's a differential two form, because it's anti-symmetrized. One can show that A is a projective, which is to say that if you apply it twice, you get A again. In fact, it's also self-adjoint, but that's not so important. Let us quickly check that this is really the case, at least for the example above. You're invited to check this in general, of course. So we want to show that if you apply the anti-symmetrization operator twice on dfdg, then you get the same as if you just applied it once. And, well, let's not go through the details. It's pretty simple to see. Please check that if you have a minute. So now we define the following. For r larger 1, remember that for r equals 0, we define the set of the 0 form to be simply the set of functions on the manifold. For r equals 1, we define that the set of 1 form is simply the set of cotangent vector fields. And now for r larger 1, we define the space of differential r form, or also exterior r form, called lambda r at the point P initially, as the subspace of totally anti-symmetric tensors of rank 0r. So we take all covariant tensors, all covariant R tensors, and we anti-symmetrize them, and the space that is left over after the anti-symmetrization, after the projection, is called lambda R of P, and that's again a vector space, and it is the space of differential R form. So if mu is an R form, then mu tilde, defined to be what you get when you apply the anti-symmetrization operator on it, is simply mu again. Because it started out anti-symmetric, so if you apply the anti-symmetrization operator on it, you get the same thing. The anti-symmetric differential R forms are eigenvectors to the A operator with eigenvalue 1, 2. Now we will follow the following strategy. We have R forms, and I already indicated that they are going to be very important for integration, for the ability to define what is integration in the first place on a generic manifold. But then, along with integration, we of course also want to have various notions of derivatives, more notions of derivatives than just the notion of cotangent vector, of tangent vector, of directional derivative. And some of you may already be familiar with most of the derivatives, such as the exterior derivative, the lead derivative, and the co-derivative, and there's an inner derivative, and how do we define them? Because we don't want to have to rely on a Newton-Leibniz way of defining those things, because that's always messy. You have to choose coordinate systems and do everything in images of what's happening in the manifold and so on. Instead, let us remember what we did in order to define tangent vectors, direction derivatives. We defined an algebra, a function germ, and then we said derivatives are derivations of the algebra. Basically, everything that is a linear map and obeys the Leibniz rule. Because just write out on paper, if you know that your map is linear and obeys Leibniz rule, you can already differentiate. So the idea is, let us try to make those differential forms into an algebra. Let's give enough structure so that they turn into an algebra, because then we can define what we will call derivation of the algebra of differential forms. And there will be more than just one notion of derivation, you will see. And then all of the derivatives that you may have heard of, and if not, you will hear of them, like the lead derivative and so on, are just special kinds of things. They just pop out of the general notion of a derivation of an algebra. So for this purpose, we now define the Z product for differential form. Because for an algebra, we need more than just the ability to add its elements, like the vector space. We also need the ability to multiply those elements of the algebra. So now we need the ability to multiply two covariant tensors. Right? This is not the usual thing. You don't multiply tensors normally. But we will define a notion of multiplication of tensors if those tensors are totally anti-symmetric covariant tensors, namely differential forms. So the definition is this. If we have a differential F form and an R form, it's called an omega and mu, then the so-called Z product will give us a new differential form whose rank will be R plus F. So the wet product of an omega and a new form will be an R plus F form. So the wet product will map any R form and F form into an R plus F form for all R and F. And exactly how it's doing it is the following. You take the S form and your R form, and then the red product of the two, of course, has to be a form again, so it has to be a covariant totally anti-symmetric tensor. And you obtain it in the following way. You simply take the tensor product of your S form and your R form, and that, of course, will give you a R plus S covariant tensor. But it won't be anti-symmetric at this point. So all you do is simply you apply the anti-symmetrization projector onto it, and then multiply with some convenient normalization factor. So this is the definition of the Z product. Just take the tensor product of the two forms. That doesn't give you a form, but after you anti-symmetrize it, you will get a differential form. For example, let's say we take the two differentials, dxi and dxj. What is their wedge product? Well, we take the tensor product. That would be dxi tensor dxj. And then we anti-symmetrize it. What do we get when we anti-symmetrize dxi tensor dxj? Well, then we get it one way around with a plus sign if we don't change their sequence. And then the other way around too with a minus sign because we made one move in the commutation. And in principle, there would be a factor of 1/2 in front of that because of the anti-symmetrization. If you remember, the anti-symmetrization operator had a prefactor of 1 over n factorial. And in our case, that n is 2, so it would be a factor of 1/2. However, we have here two 1 forms. F is 1, R is 1. So here we have a 1, a 1, and a 1 plus 1, that's a 2, which just cancels the 1/2. And therefore, we have the Tibet product of phi and phj is simply the antisymmetric version of phi and phj. No,
it's unique. I just want to mention it's unique.
No, there's just this one. Okay. Well, you can put an over or minus sign in front of it, and you could throw away stuff. You could project out other stuff, get something small. But that's the biggest image you can get that's anti-symmetric up to a month. So you could, for example, always map everything onto zero. That would be anti-symmetric, but okay. So what are the properties of the wedge product? You see, I'm not actually going very carefully. I'm not proving things, and I'm not exploring the limits and all of that. I'm trying to give you the bigger picture, and eventually we want to write the general relativity. So this is a fast track to defensive geometry. But please do ask such clarifying questions. So the properties are the following. This multiplication is bilinear. Just like a regular multiplication, it has the property that if you take two R forms, omega and mu, add them, and then take the wedge product with some other S form, then you obtain this wedge product in the usual distributive way. And you want to have a distributive law in order to be able to call your algebra an algebra. Also, it is linear, so you can take a factor here, throw it on the other side, or even put it in front of the left side for all a in the real number. Remember that all of this is still happening at a point. You also want associativity, and I invite you to prove this, that this still holds. Now, very importantly, algebras don't have to be commutative. You know that from quantum mechanics, the algebra generated by the X and P operators, for example, is an associative algebra, all right. It obeys all those axioms, but it's not commutative. You would have the Heisenberg commutation relation between the X and the P. Similarly here, we have an algebra, but it is generally not commutative. Instead, it is what is called graded commutative. So if you have an R form and an F form, then their wedge product is not the same as the wedge product between a mu form and between mu and omega. Instead, you get the same as if you multiply them the other way around up to a prefactor here. And for example, in the case where this is a one form and that is a one form, we have that R is equal one, S is equal one, and then it's just minus one here, this prefactor. So the wedge product between a one form and a two form, a one form and another one form, is not commutative, it is anti-commutative. If, however, you wanted to write down the wedge product between a one form and a two form, it would be commutative. So it is graded commutative. What sign you get depends on which forms you plug in there. So for example, if, well, I just wrote down here what I said. If you take one form, then it's anti-commutative. And the wedge product is very convenient. For example, we can take the wedge product of Bayesian vectors. Remember that we have a basis of the tangent space. It's simply the partial derivatives that come automatically if you choose a chart. Somebody's working very hard with paper here, and you can hear that. Okay, thanks. Okay, so we already have a basis of the tangent space, a convenient basis, which is coming with the chart. It's the partial derivative by the xi. And then we saw that there's a dual basis in the cotangent vector space, which is given by the dxi, by the differentials of the coordinate function. But in general, we can choose any basis we like. So let's say the theta I are a basis of the space of the cotangent space at the point P. Okay? So this is just n vectors in the cotangent space. Your choice. Nothing to do with the coordinate system. You can choose whatever basis you like. For example, you can choose the theta I to be the coordinate function's differential, or any linear combination of them such that they still span the space. So you can choose any basis, and the basis doesn't have to be attached to the charge. Then one can show that the wedge product of those basis vectors, in the R of them, is giving us a basis of the space of R form if we choose here all those vectors that we obtain when we take the basis vectors of the potential space, and we write down any arbitrary combination of indices there, such that those, this index is smaller or equal to that index, which is smaller or equal to that index, and so on. Mm-hmm. It's a little thing to show that this is so. I will give you an example. I will not go through the precise proof. Please try it yourself. I will just give you an example. What that means in practice is, since you can count how many basis vectors you obtain in this way, you can read off what the dimension is of the space of R form at the point P, n over R. This is how many basis vectors you can write down in this way. Which also means, in particular, that there are no differential forms of degree larger than the dimension of the manifold. If your manifold is four-dimensional, as space-time probably is, then there are zero forms, one form, two forms, three forms, and four forms, but no five forms. The dimension of the space of five forms would be zero. Intuitively, that's clear, because you would have to have the anti-symmetrization of five basis vectors. But since there are only four, at least one of them has to occur twice. But if you try to anti-symmetrize that, it won't work. You get zero out of it. Let me give you an example. If P is a point in the manifold, and the manifold happens to be R3, then these three are a basis of the cotangent space, which is also the space of one form at the point P. We already discussed that. And then these are, by the formula above, a basis of the space of two forms. You see, it's the set of all wedge products of two of those basis vectors, where the indices run through all possibilities such that to the left you have a lower index than to the right. So this is Vx1, Vx2, Vx1, Vx3, you see, one smaller two, one smaller three, and Vx2, Vx3.
I will come to that in a moment, that there are some special considerations if the space is three-dimensional. Yes, and then how many basis vectors do we obtain for the space of three forms? Well, now we have to write down all wedge products of these basis vectors such that to the left you always have a lower index than to the right. And there's only one option, Vx1, Vx2, Vx3. So there's just one basis vector here. Just that I invite you to prove that this is how you should do it, so I invite you to prove just a little bit over here. It's of course also in textbooks, but you may want to try it yourself. So now that we have the wedge product, and even a nice way of generating bases, we can define we can now finally define the Grassmann algebra.
We can define the algebra of differential forms. The Grassmann algebra of differential forms at the point P is simply the vector space spanned by all of the forms. So by zero forms, one form, two forms, and so on, they span a space which is called then the Grassmann algebra or exterior algebra, and it has a multiplication given by the wet product. It is an associative algebra because the wet product is an associative multiplication. And well, so far we've just defined that for a point of the manifold, but that's not hard to generalize. So what is the differential form field? Well, it's a mapping that associates to every point of the manifold an element of the Grassmann algebra, some linear combination of differential forms. And one often doesn't spell it out in this long way to say that this is a differential form field. One also would simply say it's a differential form or simply just a form and would denote it by omega. Not necessarily omega of x. It's understood that this is mapping, giving you for every point of the manifold an element of the Grassmann algebra. And together, all of those differential forms form the Grassmann algebra of all differential forms lambda of n. Then, as I promised, we will look at the derivations of the algebra. So we will consider maps that act linearly on the algebra and obey the Leibniz rule, the product rule. Just the same way that we define tangent vectors as derivations of x plus n. Here we take the algebra of differential form, and the first two derivatives that we will consider are the so-called exterior derivative and the inner derivative. But first, we define in complete generality what we mean by a derivation of the Grassmann algebra. It's so general that all of the other derivatives will be special cases of this. So a linear map, capital Phi, from the Grassmann algebra of differential forms into the Grassmann algebra of differential forms is called a derivation of degree K if it maps S forms into S plus K forms in such a way that the action on the wet product of two differential forms is obeying the Leibniz rule. Well, and linear. Yeah, I said linear, right. Okay, so it's called the derivation of degree K if the degree of the differential form that it's acting on is raised by K. And there are going to be derivations that are going to raise it by one, or also by nothing, or even might reduce the degree. Well, and we want the Leibniz rule to hold, which is to say that the derivation applied to a product is the derivation applied to alpha, leaving the second factor invariant, and then thus the first left invariant and the derivation applied to beta. Similarly, we will define antiderivations of degree k. Antiderivations of degree k also map S forms into S plus k forms. The big difference to derivations is that antiderivations don't obey just quite the usual Leibniz rule. They obey what is called the anti-Leibniz rule. So again, it looks like a Leibniz rule, but there's a minus sign at this point. It's a minus sign to the power of q. And that is the degree of the first form here. So if alpha happens to be a one form, then there is going to be a minus sign because it's minus one to the power of one. If alpha happens to be a two form, then it's going to be a plus sign here because q is two. You may wonder, why is it that this just plays out here and not over there? But there's a deeper reason to this. If you remember how derivatives act, you can view derivatives as acting by commutation. And essentially what you have is that phi will act on alpha directly, that gives you the first term. But now you have to move this symbol phi from a purely mechanical perspective or algebraic perspective, you have to move the phi past the z. You have to move the phi past the z in order to be able to act on the beta. And that is where the minus one is being picked up. I'm not saying what I just said was not a proposition or a theorem. It was just a motivation, because this is not the outcome of anything. This is a definition. Anything that obeys that is called an antiderivative. And I just wanted to give an intuition for why this might be a useful definition. You will have to see later on whether it really is a useful definition. Of course it is, otherwise you wouldn't do it. Now here's a proposition, a very important one, namely, because we have the Leibniz rule, and because we have linearity required in the definition of derivations and antiderivations, we have that any derivation is already fully specified. If you specify action on function, that is to say zero form, and then one form, that is on potential vectors. In fact, you don't even have to specify phi on all potential vectors. It suffices if you specify how phi acts on an arbitrary basis of potential vectors, which is obvious because we have linearity. If you know how it acts on a basis, you know how it acts on all potential vectors. So the point is that if you specify a derivation or antiderivative just on functions and on one form, then this determines already how phi is acting in two forms, three forms, four forms, and so on. Which can be proven from the definitions that we have so far. Here's a simple example, the so-called exterior derivative. The exterior derivative is something we already had an instance of. The exterior derivative D, the thing that we will call also the co-boundary operator, the dual of the boundary operator, is mapping the Grassmann algebra into the Grassmann algebra, and it's going to be an antiderivation of degree A equal 1. We will define it in the following way. D is mapping zero forms, which is to say functions, into one form, which is to say covariant vector fields, potential vectors. And D is the map that we already have. It's mapping functions into the differential of the function. Right? This is here, and that is an element of that. And then we also say how D, by definition, this is a definition, that's a definition, we say that D is mapping these basis vectors of the cotangent space into zero. All right. That's the complete definition of the operator D for the entire Grassmann algebra, because as we just said in the proposition before, if we know how an antiderivation acts on zero form, and we just said how it does, it maps functions into the differential. And if we also say how D acts on a basis of the cotangent vector space, on the space of one form, then this will define our antiderivation on the entire Grassmann algebra.
Play the role of integrands in integration?
They will, yes. Yes. R forms
can be integrated over other dimensional spaces. And for example, right. So, for example, if your space is four-dimensional and you have a two-form, you can integrate the two-form over two-dimensional submanifold. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. This will, of course, all be done in due time. So in the chart, it looks like this. Our operator D, the exterior derivative operator, is mapping functions into cotangent vectors, into one form, namely mapping them into the differential. And remember what that was. We proved that at the very beginning of this class today, namely that the differential of an arbitrary function is a linear combination of those basis vectors in the cotangent space with these coefficients. Now we have more generally the following. If beta is some S form, so it is some linear combination of the S-fold product of those, red product of those basis vectors. So this is the zero form here, just a function multiplying these basis vectors. And remember, well, I didn't say it before, but we just pointed out that if you have a zero form, a function, and you take the red product with a, let's say, one form, then you may as well just make that a multiplication. The red product between a function and a form is simply just the function times the form, just from the definition of the red product. So a general F form always has this form here. And then the exterior derivative operator will act on our beta here in such a way that we end up with an S plus one form, because we define our D to be an antiderivation of degree K equal one. So it is supposed to raise the degree of our differential form by one. How does it do it? Well, we know by the definition of B, the exterior derivative, that it is an antiderivative. So it obeys the anti-Leibniz rule with an appropriate minus sign. So therefore, D beta is the sum over following two types of terms. It's D applied to this, which is D applied to all of that. Which means it is D applied to beta, match product with all of this left invariant, plus this left alone, and then D applied to that, and leaving the other stuff invariant, plus leaving this invariant, applying B to the second basis vector here, leaving the rest in there, and so on. The usual way you would do the product rule. So the first term in this is B applied to this, which is what? Well, it's B applied to a function. Okay, we know what it does. It gives us a differential. And the differential is what? It's D beta by DXJ times DXJ. This is the differential of beta, okay? And then, this all of this by the product rule is left invariant, just appended behind there. And then there are other terms, as we just said, where we leave this invariant, and we have the D acting on this one or that one, so on. So we get all those other terms here. But those other terms all vanish. Those other terms all vanish, because when we apply the B to one of those, we eventually arrive at D of D xi, which is zero, which you may see intuitively, but let me just quickly prove this, and this will be the last thing we do today. D is mapping the exterior derivative, is mapping exterior form, differential form, on the differential form in such a way that if you apply D twice, you get zero. This is what we use over here. Let's quickly prove that, not hard. If you apply D twice on beta, then it's the same story as above, but now we have to apply D on, remember this was the differential here, we have to apply D on that, and that gives us the second derivative, And again, dxi, dxj equals 1. But remember that if we get the second derivative of a function, dxi, dxj, dxk, that is symmetric in interchange of j and k. But over here, we have the wedge product. And we have dxk wedge dxj. But the wedge product of two one-forms is anti-symmetric. So this is anti-symmetric, and that is symmetric. And therefore, this always comes out zero. You don't have to calculate any other term. It's clear that this comes out to be zero. Right. Well, and then I think we are out of time. But well, are there any questions? Are there any questions in Guelph? Any questions in Waterloo? Well, we lost Waterloo, it seems. To anybody who has not signed up in the sign-up sheet that went round on the first day, right, if so, please send me an email so that I can add you to the email list. Just write my email address here. Okay. I have arranged that the three main textbooks on which these lectures are based, namely the textbook by Raumann, by Hawking and Ellis, and by Stewart, will be put on reserve at the DC Library at UW. So that if you want to look something up, you can always go there and get it, at least for a day. I think it's technically 1.5 days. If you borrow it today, you can keep it until the end of the next day. And also a copy of the lecture notes of the last time I taught it, which is not completely up to date, as you noticed, is also there. You can have that as well. Okay. Any questions? No? Okay.